the importance of visual evidence when there's police shootings and police brutality, as we see today. And that's why there's such a focus on releasing body cams and dashboard cams. Of course, another lesson is with the great labor activity today, that they stand on the shoulders of the people from the past who sacrificed so much. And, you know, that's why I'm happy, you know, people can watch this film right now on PBS.org everywhere in the country. And of course, the book has the oral histories of all eyewitnesses and many of the activists who were wounded.
Greg Mitchell, director of Memorial Day Massacre, Workers Die, Film Buried. And that does it for today's show. Thanks to Tia Potenza-Smallwood and Susan Hughes here in Cambridge. Also, thanks to Dennis Moynihan and Hani Massoud. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Radio is hiring. We are accepting applications for an engagement coordinator. The engagement coordinator is responsible for sharing KBOO's mission and values across a variety of social media platforms. They also share content created by volunteers and co-sponsors. We are looking for individuals who have skills writing marketing copy and creating and editing graphic and multimedia content. To apply, send your resume and cover letter to hiring@kboo.org. Applications are due by midnight Sunday, June 4th. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. For more information, go to kboo.fm/engagement-hire.
This is KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. Up next, we have the evening news followed by Counterspin.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland Rose Festival starts tonight.
A lawsuit will force the city to remove tents blocking sidewalks.
And, in international news, the Taliban attack women's rights in Afghanistan.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 26th, 2023. I'm Sam Jones.
And I'm Josh Salem. A lawsuit settlement announced yesterday will force Portland to begin removing tents that are blocking sidewalks. The federal class action suit was brought by a group of people with disabilities who said sprawling homeless encampments keep them from getting around the city. The settlement still requires approval from the City Council and the U.S. District Court in Portland. The lawsuit was filed in September. It alleged that the city violated the Americans with Disabilities Act by allowing tents to obstruct sidewalks. The plaintiffs included a caretaker and 9 people with disabilities who use wheelchairs, scooters, canes, and walkers to get around. The City Council is already considering new restrictions on camping. The updates to Portland's camping code would ban camping between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. The council previously voted in November to create at least 3 designated campsites where houseless people will be allowed to camp. Under the tentative settlement, the city must prioritize removing tents that block sidewalks, and it has to clear at least 500 sidewalk-blocking encampments every year for the next 5 years. The city will operate a 24-hour hotline for reporting tents that are blocking sidewalks and create an online reporting portal where people can upload photos. It also will create a publicly available database of reported campsites and actions taken in response to reports made. Portland will also limit its distribution of tents to houseless people and will post no camping signs in areas where sidewalks are frequently blocked.
Under the tentative deal, the city does not admit wrongdoing or liability. Mayor Ted Wheeler said, quote, "I strongly believe that everyone should have access to sidewalks to navigate the city safely, and this is especially true for Portlanders with mobility challenges. The settlement that will come before council next week will help prioritize the city's efforts to ensure accessibility to sidewalks," end quote. The plaintiffs said, blocked sidewalks complicate their lives and sometimes even put them in harm's way. About 13% of Portlanders live with a disability, including 6% with mobility impairments and 2.4% with visual impairments. The city has to devote at least $8 million in the 2023-2024 fiscal year to ensure the conditions of the settlement are met. For the following four fiscal years, that amount changes to at least $3 million annually. The city has also agreed to pay $5,000 to each of the 10 plaintiffs, plus reasonable attorney fees. The settlement is expected to be presented to the City Council next week.
The annual Portland Rose Festival has been part of the city's history for more than a century. It's been our official festival since 2010, and it begins anew tonight. The celebration includes more than 60 events, including parades, carnival rides, art shows, dragon boat races, and fun runs. The festival website has a full list of events and activities. It kicks off with this evening's opening night fireworks show. You can see the fireworks well from the Ferris wheel at City Fair, which takes place at Waterfront Park. City Fair has carnival rides, food and beer, and live music. The Rose Festival has also served as a U.S. port of call for the U.S. Navy, U.S. Coast Guard, and the Royal Canadian Navy for over 80 years. In the event known as Fleet Week, huge naval ships line the Waterfront Park shore. Visitors can take onboard tours of many of the ships. The dragon boat races on the Willamette River include some 60 local, national, and international teams. Parades are a big part of the Rose Festival. The evening starlight parade has illuminated floats, a section with syncopated drummers, and roller derby teams. It is preceded by a 5K race, with many runners dressed in costumes. The Grand Floral Parade is the festival's hallmark event. It includes all floral floats, marching bands, equestrian units and llamas, vintage vehicles, colorful dancers, and more. The Rose Festival Court is presented, and a new reigning queen is named. The new queen is judged based on several factors, including school activities and civic involvement. She represents Portland in the Rose Festival for 1 year, at national and international appearances, and receives a scholarship. Finally, the Portland Rose Society annual Spring Rose Show, the nation's largest and longest running, has more than 4,000 flowers. It takes place at the Lloyd Center in Northeast Portland.
Democrats want to protect veterans from a default. The Supreme Court hinders clean water. And an Oath Keeper leader is sentenced for his role in the January 6th riots. With those stories and more, it's Catherine Carley with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
Veterans have given enough. They don't need to be hit again, especially by a manufactured crisis.
Vietnam veteran and Democratic Representative Mike Thompson of California says lawmakers should work through the holiday weekend to ensure the nation does not enter a historic default. Thompson says millions of veterans would be impacted by delays in pension payments, disability compensation, and health care. Experts predict the U.S. has roughly 1 week for House Republicans and the White House to reach a deal on the debt ceiling. The Supreme Court has dealt a major blow to the Clean Water Act, narrowing federal authority over wetlands. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre says the decision takes the country backwards.
The Clean Water Act is the reason why America's lakes today are swimmable, why we can fish in our streams and rivers, and why safe drinking water comes out of our taps.
The court said wetlands can only be regulated under the Clean Water Act if they have a continuous surface connection to larger regulated bodies of water. The ruling limits the Biden administration's efforts to restore protections to millions of acres of wetlands. Texas is on track to join other GOP-led states that have pulled out of a bipartisan effort to ensure accurate voting lists. The Electronic Registration Information Center, or ERIC, has become a target of suspicion among Republican activists. Texas State Representative Valerie Swanson questioned ERIC's mailings to remind eligible voters to register.
You're sending cards to people who may appear to be eligible, but perhaps they're not a citizen, or you don't realize they're a felon in some other state that's not part of ERIC.
Texas lawmakers plan to replace ERIC with their own unproven system. Florida, Missouri, West Virginia, and Louisiana have also recently left ERIC. South Carolina joined its neighboring southern states Thursday in banning most abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy. South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster says he is confident the law will withstand any legal challenges.
Ultimately, I think you'll have a lot of states addressing their laws and making them much more stringent than they are today.
Providers quickly filed a lawsuit seeking to block the law, saying it comes just 4 months after the state's highest court halted a nearly identical measure. The founder of the Oath Keepers extremist group has been sentenced to 18 years in prison for his plotting to attack the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Stuart Rhodes is the first person charged in the attack to be sentenced for seditious conspiracy. His sentence is the longest that has been handed down so far in the hundreds of Capitol riot cases. And Connecticut lawmakers are considering the most wide-ranging package of gun safety measures since the 2012 Sandy Hook school shooting. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Extreme temperatures are hitting the United States early this year. Ross Brown reports on how doctors are trying to prevent heat-related illnesses.
Extreme heat kills about 700 people in the U.S. each year, but a new toolkit and weather alerts can protect folks in Texas and beyond. According to analysis by Climate Central, the annual number of risky heat days has increased in 232 U.S. locations since 1970. Saki Malakko with the health and development nonprofit AmeriCares says the new heat.gov pilot project will help frontline clinics and the patients they serve better prepare for and respond to climate shocks.
For example, our hurricane resources remind patients to refill their medications before a major storm. For diabetic patients who depend on insulin, we remind them to keep ice packs and a cooler in the event of a power outage.
From 1970 to 2022, Reno, Nevada reported the highest number of what Climate Central calls minimum mortality temperature days. But three Texas cities, Austin, Houston, and McAllen, were in the top 10 for hottest temps. The toolkit is available in Spanish and English at heat.gov. Kimberlyn Clarkson with Texas's San Jose Clinic says doctors already are seeing health impacts to patients from high heat, including life-threatening dehydration. Those are often people, she says, who work in the ag industry or construction.
They don't have the option of not going in when it's a 99-degree day or not reporting for work if there's some sort of inclement weather. They need the work. They don't have PTO. They don't go to work. They don't earn income.
Caleb Dresser, a physician and director of Harvard University's climate program, says to create the Climate Resilience for Frontline Clinics Toolkit, a needs assessment was conducted of 450 physicians and clinicians to learn what would help them better respond to patients affected by heat waves, hurricanes, floods, or wildfires.
As we look both short-term, medium-term, and long-term at what climate change means, it means greater exposure to climate-responsive hazards for a whole lot of people all over the country.
For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
After years of legal and ethical scandals, the Republican-controlled Texas House of Representatives has moved towards impeaching their Republican Attorney General, Ken Paxton. The extraordinary, rarely used maneuver comes during the final days of the state's legislative session. Some feel the House leadership has finally had enough of Paxton's alleged wrongdoing. Paxton has aligned himself closely with former President Donald Trump and the state's hard-right conservatives against House Republican leadership. He has said the charges are based on, quote, hearsay and gossip, parroting long disproven claims, end quote. Paxton would be only the third official impeached in the state's nearly 200-year history. Under the Texas Constitution, impeaching a state official is similar to the process on the federal level. It starts in the House of Representatives, then moves to the state Senate. In this case, the five-member House General Investigating Committee voted unanimously yesterday to send 20 articles of impeachment to the full chamber. The next step is a vote by the entire 149-member House. A simple majority is needed to impeach, meaning only a fraction of the House's 85 Republican members would need to vote against Paxton if all 64 Democrats did so. If the full House impeaches Paxton, everything shifts to the state Senate for a trial to decide whether to permanently remove Paxton from office or acquit him. Removal requires a two-thirds majority vote. There is one major difference between Texas and the federal system. If the House votes to impeach, Paxton is immediately suspended from office until the outcome of the Senate trial. The General Investigating Committee met for several hours earlier this week, hearing investigators deliver an extraordinary airing of Paxton's years of alleged scandal and lawbreaking. In February, Paxton agreed to settle a whistleblower lawsuit brought by former aides who accused him of corruption. The damages totaled $3.3 million. It is unclear who pays the fee. In 2015, Paxton was indicted on securities fraud charges. He still has not stood trial. The five-member committee that led the investigation of Paxton was led by his fellow Republicans. Ex-President Trump's federal impeachments in 2020 and 2021 were driven by Democrats who had majority control of the U.S. House of Representatives. In both cases, the impeachment charges approved by the House failed in the Senate, where Republicans had enough votes to block conviction. Paxton was already likely to be noted in history books for his bizarre request that the U.S. Supreme Court should overturn Joe Biden's defeat of Trump in the 2020 presidential election.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin with an in-depth report on the Hollywood writer's strike. At 7, it's Civic Cipher. Then at 8, tune in for Squirrels Know. Do they? Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 56. Tomorrow's weather will be more of the same. The high will be a temperate 74. Today in history, in 1938, the U.S. House Un-American Activities Committee began its first session. The quote of the day is from Senator Joe McCarthy. While often associated with the group, as a U.S. senator, he had no direct involvement. And, though he was often portrayed as being extremely intense and non-yielding, McCarthy said, "I'm always chasing rainbows, waiting to find a little bluebird in vain."
Today, two top rights groups condemned the severe restrictions imposed on women and girls by the Taliban in Afghanistan. They labeled this as gender-based persecution, which is a crime against humanity. Amnesty International and the International Commission for Jurists, or ICJ, called out the Taliban crackdown on Afghan women's rights, as well as their other abuses, including imprisonment, enforced disappearance, torture, and other ill treatment. The report is entitled, "The Taliban's War on Women: The Crime Against Humanity of Gender Persecution in Afghanistan." It cited an International Criminal Court statute that lists gender-based persecution as a crime against humanity. The Taliban seized power in Afghanistan in August 2021. Despite initial promises of a more moderate rule, they started to enforce restrictions on women and girls soon after their takeover. They barred women from public spaces and most jobs, and banned education for girls beyond the sixth grade. Amnesty International and the IJC both called on their International Criminal Court to include this crime in their ongoing investigation into what is happening in Afghanistan and to take legal action. They also called on countries to exercise universal jurisdiction and hold the Taliban accountable under international law.
The report specifically accuses the Taliban of targeting women and girls who have taken part in peaceful protests by detaining them and making them more permanently disappear. They also allegedly subjected the women to torture in custody. Amnesty International documented cases of women and girls being forcibly married to members of the Taliban. The report said those who refused such marriages were subjected to abduction, intimidation, threats, and torture. The report also said the Taliban have perpetrated human rights violations against Afghan men. Several monitoring groups have documented reports of extrajudicial killings, arbitrary protests and arrests, and torture of individuals associated with the former Western-backed Afghan government. That government disappeared in the face of the Taliban takeover of the country. Finally, the report said the Taliban have also targeted journalists, the LGBTQ+ community, rights activists, and ethnic minorities. Amnesty International and the ICJ shared a summary of the report's findings with the Taliban-appointed foreign ministry. A response was not immediately provided.
Older adults are having problems with the internet and getting home health care. Shantia Hudson has the details in Alabama.
There's a pressing need for better health care support and better internet access for older adults in Alabama, according to a new report. The United Health Foundation's 2023 senior report says older Alabamians' health challenges range from inadequate internet access and health care worker shortages to early death rates. Despite an increase of 5% in the number of personal care and home health workers between 2020 and 2021, Dr. Michael Stockman with United Healthcare says the report demonstrates that many older adults aren't receiving the assistance they need.
As we try to support people in their homes, either people who have long-term disabilities or people who are recovering from surgeries and need to be at home, having that low home health care worker rate presents a significant challenge.
Stockman says the early death rate is a major concern. The report says factors like smoking rates, lack of exercise, inadequate sleep, and multiple chronic health conditions are all high among Alabama seniors. But the report shows a rise in early death rates in other states as well, reversing long-term improvement. Experts say the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on older adults has also heightened the need for community support. Stockman says Alabama ranks fairly well in that regard, promoting stronger connections and active community involvement.
Alabama seniors have a lower prevalence of excessive drinking. There's high level of community support expenditures within the state, and then that there is a low prevalence of severe housing problems amongst seniors.
The report also notes significant progress nationwide in combating food insecurity among older adults, with a noticeable 6% reduction in the nationwide rate from 2019 to 2020. For Alabama News Service, I'm Shantia Hudson.
A Montana county has delayed a decision to stop policing on the Flathead Reservation. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Lake County Commissioners Thursday delayed a decision about whether to stop county law enforcement on the Flathead Reservation. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports the county is waiting for a court to weigh in.
Lake County Commissioners pushed back the effective date for a resolution that would have stopped law enforcement services on the Flathead Reservation this week. Commissioners say the county will continue policing the reservation while a court case to determine whether the county or the state is financially responsible for that work plays out. The county filed that lawsuit last year. Governor Greg Gianforte recently vetoed a bill to pay Lake County $5 million over the next 2 years, arguing the state isn't responsible for paying for law enforcement on the reservation. Lake County, the state, and the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes entered into an agreement in the 1960s, giving the county police jurisdiction. But it's long been a question of who pays for those services. The CSKT have repeatedly declined to comment on the issue. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
A new study in Southwest Alaska on COVID-19 vaccination shows a high rate of success. As reported in the Alaska Beacon, the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation tracked COVID cases throughout 2021 and found vaccines were 92% effective in preventing hospitalizations over the year. The mostly Yupik communities in the region have no road systems to distribute the vaccines, a lack of piped water and sanitation systems, and chronic overcrowding in homes, factors that put them at high risk for the spread of COVID. Tribal governments and other health organizations helped to mobilize bush planes and snow machines to get the vaccine out to remote areas. The study found that protection waned as the virus mutated but bounced back after booster shots. The recognition for an Alaska Native soldier comes almost 80 years after he died in action in World War II. KMBA's Rhonda McBride has the story.
George Fox grew up in Unga, a tiny village in the Shumagin Islands that today has no inhabitants. He signed up for the Army in 1941, just after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. The last his family heard from him was in a letter to his father dated May 17th, 1944, written in Italy. He downplayed the dangers he faced, said he was finally seeing a little action, but told his family not to worry about him. Instead, he asked about the price of salmon and wrote, "I sure would like to be fishing again. This makes 3 seasons that I've missed." 2 weeks later, Fox died near Anzio Beach, a bloody campaign in which Allied forces lost 800 soldiers a day.
He was literally fighting the Nazis. A bomb exploded near him.
Michael Livingston spent almost a decade researching Private George Fox's story. He says he's one of the forgotten soldiers of World War II and the only Unangah to die in that war. He says Fox was buried in Italy, his remains sent years later to Alaska, where he was buried in an unmarked grave on a rocky hillside next to his mother, hidden underneath bushes that had grown over his grave.
80 years is really a long time for unfinished business. Private George Fox should have been recognized in 1944 after he was killed in action.
Last year, a headstone went up on Fox's grave, followed by a full military ceremony. This year, efforts to acknowledge his service continue. Fox's name was added to a fallen soldier's memorial in Anchorage.
This is the first time since this wall was erected that a new name has been added.
In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The United States House of Representatives votes to rescind President Biden's student debt relief program. Edwin J. Vieira has more on the story.
A new report outlines the importance of student debt relief to workers in New York and across the country. The American Federation of Teachers report finds rising education costs have forced people to borrow over $1.7 trillion to attend college. This comes as the U.S. House of Representatives passed a joint resolution of disapproval under the Congressional Review Act to overturn President Joe Biden's student debt relief program. The bill now heads to the Senate. But Mike Pierce with the Student Borrower Protection Center describes how the CRA's plan disrupts student debt cancellation for public service workers.
The student debt CRA scheme would reinstate the student loan debt of more than 260,000 public service workers nationwide, drop a nearly $20 billion debt burden onto the backs of these hardworking teachers, nurses, first responders, and service members still emerging from the pandemic.
He says this plan would roll back public workers' progress toward having more than $170 billion in student loan debt canceled. But even prior to the Congressional Review Act, court challenges had blocked Biden's plan before it began. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the case earlier this year. Michael Bukai is a law professor at SUNY's University at Buffalo. He had $102,000 in student loan debt forgiven as part of the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, and says, although the process was somewhat arduous, it was worthwhile.
I was, able to start sort of looking seriously into buying a house, and I was able to significantly increase the financial help that I give to my sibling. And I was also able to, just carry a whole lot more of the burden of, running a household with my partner.
Some education professionals identify the growth of the U.S. student loan program as erasing the benefits of going to college, with millions of loans going into default each year. The Education Data Initiative finds almost 11% of student borrowers default on their education loans in the first year of repayment, with another 25% defaulting in the first 5 years of repayment. I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 26th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. The producer for tonight's newscast is myself, Josh Salem, and our engineer is Laura Miller. Special thanks to Catherine Carley, Edwin J. Vieira times two, Shantia Hudson, Antonia Gonzalez, and Roz Brown. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Sam Jones. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, going on strike is something that people with no personal experience are comfortable depicting as frivolous or selfish. That extends to many corporate news reporters who appear unable to present a